Sports Lit 101, and joining us on the telephone, the author of Invisible Seasons, Title IX, and the Fight for Equity in College Sports. We welcome Kelly Belanger. Kelly, thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Hi, glad to be here.
Hi, Kelly. This is Bruce. We did, as you know, talk about the book before, and I want to just stress to our listeners that this is a fabulous book because you have done something no one else that I've read has done, and that's you've really taken a huge topic and a very variegated subject and put it in layman's terms and made it understandable to me. So if you could, if you wouldn't mind just sort of giving an overview of the book, and then we'll get into some of the many personalities in the story of the Michigan State women's team.
Okay, well, just briefly, I think of the book kind of in two parts. The first part of it is a story about the NCAA and the AIAW and the history of sport in terms of the role played by women physical educators and physical educators for men, and sort of two different paths that each one took, and how Title IX really forced the women to think, do we want to have sports programs more like the big-time programs of the men, or do we want to kind of keep things to ourselves with less pressure but less opportunities to really shine in the spotlight and have that opportunity for women to compete at the highest levels. So the beginning of the book really gives that background. But then the main part of the book after that gets into a story that had some personal connections for me, because when I was a basketball player at Michigan State in the 80s, I had heard about a lawsuit related to Title IX, and I didn't know it at the time, but it was also a lawsuit under the Constitution's 14th Amendment. And so I interviewed a woman who had been my sister's college volleyball coach at University of Kentucky, who also played basketball at Michigan State, and she was one of the people that really learned about Title IX when she was at Michigan State playing basketball, and got her teammates interested in learning about it and eventually trying to get the university to understand what their obligations were, and really became student activists. So, and I'm a rhetoric scholar, so I'm interested in how people persuade and how people use language and argument to make change. So I really got interested in how did these young people, really just, 18 and 19-year-olds, how did they go from, learning about this law to actually getting the attention of their university and eventually the federal government and a federal judge to get to the point where they could get some changes made to have scholarships for women and just some basic fairness about simple things like the gym they played in and money to spend on food when they went to travel for road games. So that's, a big part of the book, how all that persuasion sort of happened over time. And I guess the other thing that made me really get interested in the MSU story, besides my personal connection, is that when I found out that this lawsuit over Title IX happened in 1979, that was just a date that I always knew about growing up in the state of Michigan, because that's when Irvin Magic Johnson was the leader of the men's national championship game at Michigan State against Larry Bird. And, I think it still might be the most watched college basketball game ever, and really ushered in that kind of March Madness craziness that's now so hugely popular and lucrative for all kinds of people. So it was interesting to see how the story of the women at MSU paralleled the men's story at MSU, because it really, in a microcosm, in a small way, was an example of the larger issues that were going on around what women's sports maybe wanted to be, but wasn't sure how to get there, and wasn't sure, no one was really sure what the law would mean.
Well, Katie DeBoer, I assume, is the athlete you're talking about, is a really compelling character. And I mean, I realize I shouldn't say character, very compelling person in this narrative, along with Mary Pollock and Mark Pittman and so many other people involved. One of the things I think that a lot of people don't understand that these women were up against is this wasn't one opposition. There were people who wanted to go back to the old days, where women's had intramurals and play days, and the physical education people were in charge of all athletic things for women. You had other people that still believed it was going to be the end of their reproductive abilities if they played sports. And then you had other people from a very ardent pro-feminist side who were saying, yeah, well, we don't want separate but equal. That didn't work in civil rights. We want a full equality where everybody can play on the same team in the same game. So this was what I'm so impressed with these young women was this was not an easy thing to parse out, to figure where all these different oppositions were coming from, whether it's Bo Schembechler writing to President Ford and telling him that, you know, next thing you know, the girls will want a Rose Bowl. That as you say, it's the persuasion that is so interesting to me in this, how they were able to convince themselves, along with, you know, the people that were standing in their corner, to go ahead and do this, because this is no small thing. I mean, this was a huge thing to get the 14th Amendment invoked in what was basically women's sports.
Right. And I think it's interesting you use the word character because, you know, in writing the book and researching it, I think that's what drew me in. When I knew a few of these people that I wrote about, but I didn't know them well. And as I started learning about, you know, their attorney, Jean Ludwig King, and the Title IX coordinator at the time, Mary Pollock, and all the women on the team, and Mark Pittman, who was the women's cross-country coach, but also a big fan of the women's basketball team, I started to see that they were interesting characters. And, you know, when they had to go on the stand in the trial that's discussed, that I discuss in part of the book, they really knew, maybe they weren't the most articulate, all of them. Some of them were, some of them weren't. They really had to be sort of coached. But they were smart women who knew what they were about and were kind of selfless about it, really. They could see a bigger picture and had a strong will, especially once one of their biggest advocates, Mary Pollock, who was in their early 30s, pretty young woman herself, as the Title IX coordinator, was fired by the university. That really motivated them, even some of them who might have been on the fence, to really bond together and have the courage to take some risks and really try to communicate to the adults around them what they understood about the law that, you know, looking back, it turns out they were right.
So, Kelly, then and perhaps even now, what are the biggest misperceptions about Title IX?
Wow. Well, I think there still are a lot of misperceptions. Probably the biggest one now might be that it's sort of done its job and, it's changed everything and we have something pretty similar to equality right now, or at least enough equality for a lot of people. And I think, you know, people don't realize that Title IX, initially there was a lot of debate about whether it should be a law whether it should apply to sports at all to begin with. And then once that part kind of got determined, yes, it does apply to sports as well as to, you know, all areas of education that's got any public funding, federal funding, the question sort of became, what would equality mean under Title IX? Would it mean splitting resources right down the middle, half and half, half for the men, half for the women? Or would it mean just having, you know, one single program and everybody had to try to compete and whoever, you know, fit the requirements would get to play and be on the team? And so, as it turned out, it really became more of a gender equity law than an equality law. And it has many parts to it. It's a very flexible law with many different ways to comply. And I think, you know, because different parties, the NCAA and, you know, feminist groups and women athletes, all kinds of people were lobbying and trying to have an impact on how equality would be defined under Title IX, it did get a little complicated. And it is a little messy to really go into an actual institution, an actual sports program, and really get down to the details of, you know, how resources are being allocated. And I think because of that, I think a lot of people don't really understand that it's a law that's trying to move things forward toward equality, but it actually doesn't mandate something that to most people would look like true equality, because there's exceptions for certain sports that might have, quote, kind of special needs, which sort of was a way of, under the Javits Amendment, thinking about football, that might need, you know, more money because there's, you know, a lot of hitting, so they need more equipment to protect people and, you know, a lot of people on the team, and arguments that, you know, everybody might not buy into, but there were these sort of loopholes, and they're still there, that really make this very flexible law sometimes hard to understand and sometimes not really able to support what we might think of as full equality.
We're talking with Kelly Belanger, the author of Invisible Seasons. And Bruce and I talked about this when we were discussing the book a couple of weeks ago. A couple of congressmen have said we need to revisit Title IX because of the burden that it puts on schools, that they have to have people enforcing and keeping track of Title IX. But, and I think you touched on this a little bit already, that's not the fault of the law as much as it is the NCAA.
Yeah, you know, I think early on the NCAA, you know, is somewhat to blame because they represented the men's athletic establishment at the time, and at first their idea was to just fight against Title IX, to fight against women's sports being, you know, required, having to share any resources with women's sports, and they wanted Title IX not to include football and, you know, any of the bigger revenue-generating sports that the men had. So part of the reason that Title IX became such a sort of compromised law is initially because of the NCAA. I think, you know, later the NCAA has become a bit more of a friend of Title IX in some ways. You know, they do require, beginning in the 90s, for schools to publish their data about equity in terms of teams and opportunities and scholarships and resources given to different parts of the sports program. So that information is actually made available through gender equity report cards through the NCAA, complying with a law that actually requires that, the 1994 Equity in Athletics Disclosure Act. It's not, the NCAA doesn't enforce anything, but they do make some of that transparent now. So I think they're a little more helpful and friendly toward Title IX, definitely, than they were early on, but they certainly played a role in some of the complications that came up along the way.
Now, basketball plays the greatest role in this of any sport. I mean, I've been reading a lot of it. Just finished Dust Bowl Girls by Lydia Reeder, great book about how basketball was really that first team sport that women gravitated to, even though the old six-player game wasn't as exciting. But what I found really interesting in all that is that when we look today at basketball and how huge women's basketball has become, it's really been the success of teams that have done really well. Certainly UConn, and before that Tennessee, before that Delta State. But I think most people don't realize we didn't have an NCAA tournament for women until we were into the 70s. And prior to that, really no one was paying any attention.
Right. And really, it was even later. I mean, for me, I played college basketball from 82 to 86. And I believe 1982 was the first year that Michigan State, where I played, was in the Big Ten. Mm. And, you know, I do think there was an NCAA tournament. There was during my time in college, but I almost didn't hardly know it existed because it wasn't on television. It wasn't talked about very much. It was almost as if it didn't exist. And even that, I think it was that first year, maybe there, was it 82 or before that, they actually, had both an AIAW and an NCAA tournament for women's basketball competing against each other, for attention and for resources. And ultimately the NCAA, won out, and the women's, AIAW had to go out of business. So there was a period in time when they even overlapped for one season.
Right. Now, when you were playing, too, at Michigan State, is that in the hiatus period when we didn't really have Title IX because of the Grove City case?
That's right. And that's another thing, you know, as an athlete, I didn't even know that was going on. So it's been so fascinating to look back and to learn this history later on. Yeah, because in the early 80s, Title IX officially legally did not apply to sports athletics, but, you know, still to the rest of the university. And that was still the period when this lawsuit at Michigan State was not completely wrapped up. And so it was kind of a dark period for, you know, women's sports in many ways. And I think it's a testimony to the women of that time period and earlier who just kept on playing because they loved athletics, they loved to compete, they believed in what they were doing even if no one else cared. And I think that's what made it possible for, you know, it to things to change, you know, after that into the 90s and afterwards.
Well, I think you've done a phenomenal job in this book explaining that to people and letting people see it. I want to carry Mary Pollock around on my shoulders in a stadium for all the work that she did and all those brave young women and the guys who helped them out, too. I just tell everybody who's listening, Invisible Seasons is a great book, and I really hope you'll go out and get it. And it's been a joy to have you with us, Kelly, and thanks so much for being on Downtown today.
Okay, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Kelly Belanger, author of Invisible Seasons, here on Sports Lit 101.